The casing is intestine, lamb, beef, or veal intestine, or even all the way down. It depends on the size. This is a pretty small one, so we're going to get a pretty good one. Bruce, I'd like you to be the catcher today. Ready? Well, look excited. Now we're just going to shove this stuff through, and it's going to come. Touch it, Bruce. Touch it.
Yeah! Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. My name is Phil, I'm your host, and we're doing things a little bit different this time. We've got a guest in studio, my friend Sean, big friend of the show.
Hi, how's it going?
Welcome, Sean.
Thank you.
Welcome to the internet.
I'm ready for it.
You've been on a podcast before?
No, I haven't.
You ever been on any radio show?
No, I have not.
Oh,
yeah, nice. First time.
Well, Sean is... an undergraduate student at Cal Poly Pomona?
Yes, yeah.
His university here in Southern California, and you're studying agriculture?
Yeah, it's the second largest horticulture program in Southern California, or in California.
And your degree is horticulture or agriculture?
My degree is agriculture biology.
Okay.
With a minor in agronomy and a minor in pest management.
Fascinating.
So.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So you're close. You're going to graduate in June, right?
Yeah, I'll be graduating next quarter, actually. Yeah, looking forward to that.
Awesome. So we thought we'd bring Sean in and kind of quiz him and ask him a shitload of questions, stuff that we've been thinking about asking for a while, about agriculture and the state of food in America. And because you got all the answers. Every time I ask you a question, you got an answer. So I figured, you know, what the hell. So basically from what you've learned... so far, and what you've gathered and everything, how do you see the state of food, the future for food in America? What do you see us going in, say, 10 to 20 years?
Well, you know, actually, this is a really interesting conversation because, you know, we're so concerned, the United States is so concerned about terrorism, bioterrorism, homeland security, immigration. You know, they have all these foreign policies going on. But they have really no strong domestic policy towards food. We had food safety principles established. You know, we check for E. coli and salmonella. We're heavily regulated into the microbiology of food safety. But as far as a national program for food, we have no domestic agenda for food. Basically, our food is going to be outsourced within 10 to 20 years. If you look at now, we have a lot of agriculture commodities that are already outsourced. For one, is because of land and water. These are the two main issues facing California. California, by far, up until recently, is still the number one state producing of agriculture, of fruits and vegetables, but that's diminishing. As recently as 15 years ago, we had about 12.5 million acres. Right now, we have 8.5 million acres in production. Within the next 10 years, we will have 6.8 million acres. So therefore, we've had a 50% loss in about 15 years.
Now, why are we having a loss? Is it because people are building
houses? I mean, if you look at an acre in Southern California, you can sell that acre for easily $500,000, just topsoil, you know. Where growing tomatoes, you can only make a profit of, say, maybe $40,000 per acre.
Wow.
And so it's not sustainable to have that much land or have land here because the market, the housing value is high, or at least the property value is high.
So is it not financially feasible for somebody to own a farm?
Basically not. Not at this point. You in order to have a farm, you got to have at least, you know, 85 acres, 100 acres a minimum, because this whole industry is run by big agribusiness companies. And these guys are the one who are just in charge of, they control the price, the values, and the land itself. You know, the middleman is being squeezed out. And so if you look at our food supply, there's so many issues. Like just water alone. Water rights are just incredible. Like in the Piro Valley right now, you can buy flat land, arable land, desert farmland for, say, $40,000 an acre, right? Well, that's pretty sustainable in a sense if you have, say, like, 45 acres, you can grow some crops on that. You can grow alfalfa, you know, you can grow strawberries, you can grow artichokes, right, et cetera, right? Well, it requires a lot of water to support those crops. You're talking just perennial crops. You're talking 2 to 3 acre feet of water a year.
So water becomes the most precious commodity.
Right. And if you look at water alone, farmers don't get the water. The people get the water. So LA gets the water and San Diego gets the water, right?
Right.
So basically what they do is they tax the water really high so farmers can't afford to buy water. So therefore when they have no water, they can't grow the crops.
So this is being done on purpose to force farmers out.
To force farmers out and get the water to the city. To the people,
man.
You know, you're talking at Cal Poly Pomona, where I go to school. We have 1,200 acres of farmland, and basically we grow citrus of all different varieties, mandarin tangerines, grapefruits, fruvas, and all types of vegetable crops, and we pay about $30 an acre right now. Well, that's relatively very cheap, and it's very affordable to grow crops there, right?
Right.
But say you go to San Diego County and you want to grow avocados, right? An avocado tree uses 4 to 5 acre feet of water per year. That's 1 acre foot is 325,000 gallons of water. So we times that by 4 or 5 feet. Mm. It's a lot of water, right?
Right.
They're paying up to like $600 to up to $1,000 per acre foot.
Wow.
You know, so the money is just, it's just astronomical for water.
So they're raising the rates on their water.
Yeah.
And causing and forcing restrictions on them too.
Right.
So
right.
It's even harder now for American farmer to make a buck.
It means, right. So as a result, what's happening with this is that these farmers are cashing out and they're going to go to Mexico or they're going out of the country. And not so much even the farmers, but the corporations are. You know, I went to a ranch in Santo Tomas, which is in the Baja California. Mm-hmm. It's 70,000 acres. It's approximately 18 miles along the Baja coast. It's where the Baja 1000 occurs. You know, they drive their buggies right through this property. And it's 18 miles, 70,000 acres on the coast, and it's controlled by 24 corporations that are here in the States.
So it's an American-controlled company in Mexico.
Yes, 24 different corporations. So, I mean, they're like, you got all of them. You got all the main produce brands down there.
And more than likely kickbacks to the government.
Oh, I'm sure.
Wow.
Absolutely. You know, and there, you know, it's bribery. If you can bribe the politicians to get water, then you're set to go because the land's really cheap.
How much support are American farmers getting from the government then? Almost none?
From the
U.S. government.
U.S.
Yeah.
government? There are actually, if you're talking like the big farmers, we're talking like 1,000 acres or plus, then there are some kickbacks.
So you've got to be humongous in order to get any kind of support from the government.
Absolutely.
So if you're a small farmer, you're kind of screwed.
Or a middleman farmer.
You're gone. Wow.
You got to be the big crop. The farming industry is extremely competitive.
Right.
It's a ruthless industry. You know, if you don't make ends meet, either by insect pest control or by... You know, if you have a frost that comes in, mm-hmm. you know, cold weather comes in and wipes out your crop, there's no insurance for that. You know, you lose out.
Let's say you want to be a local farmer and you want to just basically start a farm. Let's say, my uncle died and left me 5 acres of land here and, uh-huh. and wherever. And I've got farming experience. I've been working on farms my whole life, so I know what I'm doing. But this is 5 acres of open land. I want to start a farm.
Right.
What process does he have to go through to open that farm, to get things rolling? Does he have to, like, file papers with the government saying, you know, I want to grow food, I want to sell it to the public? What's the process for somebody that wants to open a farm?
Well, first of all, if you buy your land or you inherit land, your first issue is you want to know what you're going to pay for water. That's the number one concern. I want to know what it's going to cost me to grow my vegetables
right.
or to grow my trees. So you want to find out what it costs acre feet of water. That's number one. Second of all, you have 5 acres. You got to make a decision. Are you going to grow annuals, perennials, or perennials? Annuals, biennials, or perennials. Basically, you're going to grow plants or you're going to grow trees. That's another main decision. Because if you grow trees, you're going to have to plant it. You're going to grow 5 years, minimum 5 years, before you even pick a fruit, before you make a single dollar.
Well, is there a higher profit margin for people who raise animals over growing things in the ground?
No. If you look at animals, you know, if you like a basic example, if you look at a 1,000-pound steer, the space of that 1,000-pound steer is say 6 feet linear in length, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just think of how many 5-acre-gallon pots you can put on this table. You know, basically, if you use up all your space and just grow plants, you can make more money off that.
Okay, so there's more money in actual produce than in growing animals for slaughter.
Yeah, it depends on like if what type of animals you're raising. Like if like for example, my industry, what I want to get into, like my own personal adventures I want to get into, is I want to start raising beefaloes.
Beefaloes.
Now, beefaloes, I can make money. Beefaloes.
Is that a cow and a buffalo together?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Wow. And there's two different crosses. There's 3/8 cross and 5/8 cross.
That
and
sounds wrong. That's like, you know, sleeping with your sisters.
It's a little ethical, huh?
Yeah. Is there such a thing as a beefalo, or are you going to invent this yourself?
No. Actually, the last beefalo that was in La Habra was in 1980.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're bringing it back.
I want to bring it back.
You're bringing beefalo back.
You know, if I get into micro niches like that, you know,
right?
I can make money on raising cattle, you know.
Okay.
And so basically, if you're looking at like rangeland, and you have 5 acres, you basically put one. It depends on, again, it depends on the topography and the amount of rainfall and what type of grass you feed it or alfalfa or hay. But you look at like for 5 acres, you'd raise 5 cows. But if I was to raise like my livestock, I'd do concentration. I'd put them in like 15-foot slabs, all cement with some pasture land.
Gotcha.
You know, and basically I'd want to eliminate as much contact to the soil as little as possible.
So I've checked out how much water is going to cost me from the city.
So
now what?
So second of all, then you just make your beds. You got to have the equipment. You got to have the machinery.
So you got to go buy the gear.
You got to buy the gear, or you got to lease it out, or you got to rent it out. And so you got to go in and get your equipment and have access to that. And then you got to know what type of seeds you want to grow.
Right.
So seeds are a big concern, you know.
So you got to start with some capital here, because
absolutely you got to have capital.
You got to be self-sustainable for at least, you say, what, like a year?
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, or at least yeah, I'd say a good five or six months.
Okay.
If you're gonna go vegetable crops. Yeah.
Now, is the government, like, if I say, when I file papers with the government saying I'm about to open this business, does the government help them out at all to get them started? Or is there any kind of like a starter thing that they, like, you know, farmer welfare or something?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of. Yeah. So basically, once you make your beds and you get your equipment and you have access to that, you're taking out big loans, because you're gonna either buy used or you're gonna buy new.
Right.
Typically, you're gonna buy used equipment and you're gonna get some help. But now here comes the lot of laws and regulations. Now you have insect pests. You have basically worms or caterpillars. You have beetles. You have different types of bugs or insects that come in and eat up your leaves and eat up your fruit and cause damage. Now here comes the insecticides, the pesticides, the fungicides, the herbicides, weeds, right? That's when a lot of these laws and regulations come in, especially here in Southern California. I mean, there's so strict about chemicals, you know. You as a farmer either have a PCA, a pest control advisor's license, or you have to hire someone to come out and have those license. And then that's where all the filing and paperwork comes in, you know. The California EPA has got such strict laws towards applying chemicals that you gotta make sure that the chemicals are being applied are not gonna contaminate the groundwater, or they're not gonna have a long residual effect in the soil.
Right. So it's environmentally conscious at the same time.
Absolutely, yeah. And so, yeah. Whereas if you grow crops out of the country, like say Mexico, there are different laws and regulations.
Right.
So
wow.
You can get away with a lot more.
Now, I recently printed this out. I printed one for you too, so we could talk about this. There's an agricultural budget, the president's 2008 agricultural budget. Do you know when this came out? Was this recent, or is this part of the new $3.1 trillion that he asked for today?
Actually, I've heard about this in the news within the last couple of weeks, but I'm not sure if it all came out with the same budget or not.
Well, they're saying it's going to ensure the continuation of a strong farm economy, protect the nation's food supply, develop sustainable forests, promote nutrition assistance programs, and encourage development in rural America. So it's broken down to a bunch of different sections, and $5.4 billion for a special supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children, which, you know, it's food education. I understand that. How much of this is actually going to the farmers?
You know, well, the thing is that if you have budgets like this that are making a transition, say like these food stamps, you know, like food stamps is a prime example. You have, say, a budget of like $25 per week you can spend on food, or $30 a week, right? But none of these formulas incorporate fruits and vegetables or lettuce you know, or any types of fruits and vegetables, and that's such a critical part in a stabilized diet, right?
Right, right.
You know, so if you can insert like produce and bananas and lettuce, you know, that helps out the farmers. You know, therefore they can add that into the budgets and they can produce more fruit for that. You know?
Sure.
And I think that's good that the government is willing. If we're gonna have these safety zones set up for people, for men, women, and children, we need to have them have a well balanced diet. We need to incorporate these fruits and vegetables. You know.
Right.
So, I agree with this program. And since if they're gonna have these programs, they need to incorporate food.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely.
So yeah.
You know, we're getting on one thing that you were talking about earlier. The argument for importing produce from other countries,
yeah,
is to, I don't know, to keep, and this is the argument, to keep American farmers on their toes and to force fair trade, right? Yet, I read that 2%, less than 2% of the produce that's imported from other countries actually gets looked at and investigated and inspected by the FDA.
Oh, I believe so as well. I mean,
yet they're going to keep their eyeballs on the American farmer to make sure that, you know, that they're not using, you know, pesticides and that their food's fresh.
It sounds like backwards to me.
It totally does. It sounds to me like they're playing favorites, or they're really not concerned with our health. I mean, how am I far off the base there, or is that?
No, I think you've hit it right on the head. I mean, we are exporting. We're going to be able to export more produce than what we grow here. We're at 8.8 million acres, right? Or 8.8 million acres right now in California. If we get below 6 million acres, we will not be able to sustain the United States. Well, we can be able to sustain the United States. We cannot sustain the world.
We're still exporting more than we're eating here, though, right?
Oh yes, we are. Yeah, I mean, if you look at grains alone, I mean, grains and rice. I mean, that's all going to export.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, a lot of it is. Yeah. California is surprisingly, we see fruits and vegetables all the time. We go to the grocery stores, we see strawberries and grapes. We eat a lot of fruits, right?
Right.
But other parts of the country, they don't eat a lot of fruits. They don't have access to, I mean, they have access to a lot of fruits, they just don't have good quality fruits.
But by the time they get, you know, they make it from here to there, they're rotted.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at this, that's an interesting question. You know, it's called post-harvest production, you know, quality control issues. They don't grow strawberries for taste. They grow strawberries for transportation. Like, how long does it take for a strawberry to get from point A from Ventura County to Japan by boat, right? It's about 14 days. So what they do is they grow produce for shipping. They don't grow it for quality.
Right.
And it's all based on the consumer. You know, the consumer wants something that's red as a strawberry, but they don't really care about the taste, because if it didn't taste good, if you don't like an item by the way it tastes, you just don't buy it. You put a boycott on the item. It makes a transition. Makes the farmers say, "Hey, you know what? We better change our recipe." You know. So
right. Well, there's this whole thing that grocery stores, and the reason why I, you know, kind of came out against grocery stores in the last episode, but grocery stores are really shitty about this. They'll only buy the stuff that looks the best.
Right.
You got a crooked eggplant or a crooked cucumber? I don't want it. Give me the straight stuff. I want it to look nice.
Right.
Now, how much of that is going to waste?
Oh, huge amounts.
A shitload, right?
Huge amounts. I worked for Vaughn's Produce for 10 years, and I have quite a knowledge and extensive network of how the produce industry works. It's amazing. We throw away a good easily 35-40% of our produce that we brought in. You know, we throw away every day one full pallet of raw and decaying produce, or just fruit that has cosmetic damage done to it. You know?
Right.
If it's not uniform with all the other fruits, we'd get rid of it.
This is what is irritating the crap out of me about this country, is that we've got so much food. We're so rich, and it's despicable how rich we are, and yet we have shit like food, you know, food eating contests, hot dog eating contests. There's assholes that made a 222-pound hamburger last week, you know, in Stockton. We've got massive amounts of food, and we've got other countries throughout the world that are starving.
Right now,
we've got too much food.
Right now, we can more than double. We have enough food right now to feed every single person on this planet. What the United States produces, we can feed every single person. But there's a lot of restrictions to that, because what basically has to happen is that every person has to go on a diet, a 2,000 calorie diet per day,
right?
You know, and there's a lot of people that don't want to do that, or at least the big people in power don't want to do that. you know, and there's...
There's no way you can enforce a 2,000-calorie diet on somebody.
Not only that, you can't get to logistics to all these different places.
Right.
You can't. I mean, you can't get trucks to certain places in Kenya right now because of civil war.
I'm telling you, one slice of that freaking hamburger is probably 2,000 calories right there. You know, half a cow, 1,500 slices of cheese. You know,
absolutely, man.
So basically, what we're doing is forcing farming. We're forcing it to die here.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's because people are not connected with their food source, you know. They don't know where the tomatoes are grown. They don't know where their meat comes from. I mean, in theory, they do. You know, they know it comes off a plant or it comes from a cow. But they don't know exactly what type of breed it is. They don't know where these breeds are, where they're from, where they're grown at. You know, there's a huge disconnection with where the food that we eat compared to where it's grown, you know. Right. And these people have never been on a farm. They've never smelled cow shit before. They never smelled manure or fertilizers. You know, they have no idea what it's like for honeybees to come in and pollinate a tomato plant. I'm sorry, bumblebees that would pollinate a tomato plant in a greenhouse. You know, like my background is my grandfather's a dairy farmer from Arkansas, and he has 200 acres and he raises grows of cows. So I grew up every summer riding horses and breaking my arms on horses and getting bucked off of bulls. You know, as for fun.
Right.
And I learned a lot by working on the ranch. And, you know, my simplest jobs are from a young boy, was walking the fields, and my grandpa would say, just throw the rocks to the side. You know, so I'd have a little tractor trailer, and I'd be like 8 years old, and every rock I see on the field, I had to pick it up and throw it in this bin, you know. And that was my job. But as I got older, I had a lot more responsibility.
Dude, nowadays, that's child abuse, right?
The kids don't know what it's like to work, you know. Right. People don't work their kids, you know. And so, I mean, I have a good idea what it's like. I mean, I've had my own, my personal experiences. I've had 6 bulls. I've had limousine crossed with Charolais. I've had 2-way crosses and 3-way crosses with limousines, Black Angus, Charolais. Yeah, basically there's 3-way crosses with a couple other breeds in there as well.
You raised them?
Yeah, I raised them all myself, yeah.
And killed them.
Raised them all, yeah. I got them as, like, basically veal-sized calf at about 200, a little under 200 pounds. And I castrated them as well, so they were steers. And then I get them up. My last steer I raised was 1,340 pounds. And
Jesus.
I killed them. I got about a little over 900 pounds of edible meat, delicious steaks, tri-tips, top sirloins, chuck steaks.
Really?
In my freezer, deep freezer, you know, and I had that. And for over about 9 months.
Now, how long does it take to grow this animal to that size?
Well, you get the animal at about total from birth to death is approximately 15 months.
15 months.
15 months.
And how much does it cost you to keep that animal alive for those 15 months?
See, so I'd already get the animal, and it's already a couple months old. But if I was to raise it from say, day one, it'd cost me... Well, I'd have the animals for 10 months, and it cost me $400 in feed.
$400
in feed alone.
What about water?
Oh, I didn't count water. I just fill up. I just got water from the tap water and just filled up a big jug, mm-hmm. big gallon, yeah.
So now, do you have to give them medicines and stuff?
No, I don't give any antibiotics.
No antibiotics.
Yeah. The only thing I do is I put a magnet down its throat.
A what?
A magnet.
A magnet.
Yeah, a magnet, probably 3 inches in length, half inch thickness, probably weighs, I don't know. I don't know what it weighs. It's not too heavy. You know,
the hell do you do that for?
A pound.
So, well, you can catch it? You come over with a big spaceship with a big magnet on it?
You basically, cattle, they're ruminant animals. So they have basically, in theory, they have a 4-chamber stomach. And so the first stomach is called the rumen. And basically that's where...
the magnet is.
The magnet's at, yeah. It's about 50 gallons, the size of the stomach.
Holy
and
crap.
So basically that's where all the water's at, bacteria's at. And that's where all the hay or the grains go into that. And so basically cows, they like to chew on things, you know. Unfortunately, they will eat metal. They will eat, you know, not so much metal, but they'll pick it up, and if they swallow it, you know, it will cause internal bleeding. I mean, they'll cut the lining. So you put this magnet in there, and anything metal attracts the metal. So basically, once you kill the animal, you grab that magnet from it, and typically you will find metal shrouds wrapped around that magnet.
Wow.
You know, it prevents it from going any farther.
Okay, smart.
You know, so you don't want to go farther down in that digestive tract.
So $450 for grain.
For grain, yeah.
And then water, you really can't.
Yeah, I didn't.
Tell how
I didn't add that into my calculations. I typically will pay $25 for insurance on the animal mm-hmm. in case if it dies of natural causes. Not from my own negligence or my own abuse, but natural causes. And on top of that, per head, it ranges about $1.25 a head, $1.25 per pound.
What?
For the initial price.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so I've
accidental death, not a death because you put a bullet in its head.
Right. Then I'd get reimbursed for the money I spent. Okay. But so initial cost, I spent about $400 or so for the animal. Sometimes a little bit more. Sometimes I spend $600 per head per animal, and then I'd pay for feed. It costs another $450. So I'm looking at $1,000.
And then what would a farmer get for that cow?
Oh, it depends on that depends on the market. You know, it depends on when you sell the animal.
So there's a market price.
Oh, absolutely.
Fluctuates.
Absolutely.
What causes that fluctuation?
Oh, supply and demand.
Oh, really?
And the cost on energy.
We have too many cows. We're not paying you as much as we were paying you last month.
Right. It also depends on export as well, too. So if there's like embargoes, like you know, when we had like mad cow disease, you know, Japan and some Asian countries, you're like, oh, they put all these restrictions and embargoes on cattle, so the price of cows it dropped. Basically, you know, because there was a big outbreak and big concern about cow disease, you know, so
yeah,
cow disease is a really interesting topic as well.
Yeah, I kind of talked, I hit on that in the last show. It's pretty sick. People get grossed out by it and stuff, and like, oh, I'm trying to eat lunch. And you know what? Don't eat lunch when you're listening to my show, because I'm going to talk about a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
you
know, right, usually
it's going to be kind of gross, but yeah.
You know, it's interesting about mad cow disease is that, you know, you can only really diagnose mad cow disease once the cow has passed. Cow, bull, steer, bovine is after 7 years of age.
Right. Now, we were talking about this before we started talking earlier. You said that there were downer cows that wouldn't get up off the ground.
Uh-huh.
Because they didn't want to walk. And I said, no, when I see a cow like that, it immediately makes me think it's got, you know, BSE.
Mm-hmm. Bovine spongiformis epilepathy.
Yes, that one. And you said, no, that's not true. It's not always the case. It's just sometimes they just don't want to get up.
Well, typically BSE is a brain wasting disease, which will make the animal wobble and lean and just not walk in circles. It's kind of like humans having Alzheimer's disease. You know, they really can't think for themselves. And so I've seen cows that just go like basically straight mad. I mean, they're just, you know, twisting and turning and jerking, you know, like I almost say a Parkinson's disease.
Right.
And those are clinical symptoms of BSE. But the problem is that we've only had a few cases in the United States and more cases in Europe. And the reason we have such few cases in the United States is because we kill our cows before they reach age 7 or 8, 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, definitely all of our beef is killed within 18 months. Typically, it's 18 months of lifespan for beef. For our hamburgers, not from our steers, it's 18 months. But for cows, you know, from the dairy industry, it's really interesting. I mean, if they have it down so precisely that if this cow, say B113, is not producing the same milk it was producing yesterday or, say, a week later,
they're going to whack it.
They're going to whack it. It's out of the line. It's gone, you know. And dairy, the dairy industry is such a... It's science, man. It's really incredible, detailed. Like, they have such... Everything they feed the animals, it's measured to the quality that they want. I mean, these farmers grow their alfalfa to what the dairy wants, you know? And so dairies only feed their cows, typically just... not so much grains, but alfalfa, right? Well, now let's just say, when you talk about BSC, you know, you have a steer, and basically after you kill the animal, you grind up the bones and you get some other bones, some other carcasses.
And that shit ends up in the feed that the cows eat.
The calcium, right? And then you feed it right back to the offspring, right? The progeny of these
cows. So
you're
forcing cannibalism on the cow.
Absolutely, right? And so therefore that cow will eat it, digest it, and get large concentrations of it, and eventually it will affect the cow, right?
Right.
Well, that's in the beef production, right? Well, that was going on all up until a couple years ago, and we've had that process going on for the last 100 years, you know?
Right.
That has not changed, except we had no clinical signs of BSE because all of our cows are being killed at 18 months old.
Oh.
You know,
could technically have it.
Oh, we know for sure they've had it. They just haven't shown any physical signs of it because they've all been killed. You know, you understand what I'm saying?
I follow you.
So the whole nutritional ratio has changed in the last couple of years.
Fuck this! I'm going to become a vegetarian. Oh man, that sucks. Wow, that's too much, man.
Yeah, man. You know, and
Dude, you're depressing me. You're depressing everyone listening to the show. Get out. You're not coming back. Well, listen, we got to wrap it up.
Okay.
You think you can come back?
Absolutely.
And come back?
Yeah, anytime.
Maybe
man.
Next time?
Absolutely.
All right, dude. Listen, thanks again for coming down. I was looking forward to having you on, and you're a wealth of knowledge. Kind of depressing, though. Holy crap. We're not going to have vegetables anymore, and our beef all has shit in it. Okay, well, listen, that's the show. Thanks for tuning in. I know it's a little different. We didn't talk about any beers, and we didn't cook anything, and I didn't read any articles, but maybe next time. Hey, we got to do different stuff sometimes, though. What can I say? All right, that's it. This is My Life as a Foodie. Sean, signing off.
Thank you.
Yep.
Adios.
Thank you, and we'll see you guys next time. Ciao.